From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the Kewaunee nuclear plant has stopped producing power. Now what happens? Later, swimmer Dara Torres talks about her long Olympic career and being a role model to her daughter and the world. Plus, Wisconsin foodie Kyle Cherik on Milwaukee's surprising restaurant boom.
I mean, I've lived in Walker's Point for now 17 years, and when I moved in, I was just happy to get a gas station. Now, you can essentially get some of the best food in the entire city.
And a Sheboygan woman talks about her surprising story of becoming an entrepreneur.
And lo and behold, I was left with about 500 lifetime supplies of lip balm, and thinking to myself, what on earth am I going to do with this all? That's really where my story starts.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Great to have you listening today. Less than 24 hours ago, the Kewaunee Power Station in Wisconsin became the first nuclear power plant in this country to be shut down since the late 1990s. Virginia-based Dominion Resources decided to stop producing power at the plant when the utilities which bought the power elected not to renew their contract with Dominion. Ahead of the shutdown, WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz spoke with Dominion spokesman Mark Cans about how the process that started yesterday actually takes place.
We'll open the breaker, quit producing electricity to the grid, and then we'll go about actually shutting the unit down. Once we get the unit cooled down enough, we'll move the fuel out of the unit and move that into the spent fuel pool. There are a number of maintenance types of activities that that do need to take place, and all the systems will be drained of water. And then basically you'll see not a whole lot of changes taking place physically here at the site for a good number of years. The mode of decommissioning that we've chosen is called Safe Store. And so what we'll do is all the equipment will go into a dry layup condition, so all the lines will be drained. And that will give some time for the parts that are radioactive to decay over time, and that'll make it much safer and much less expensive to decommission when we get to the part of actually taking buildings apart and that type of thing.
Oh, so really, ultimately, the buildings will come down?
Ultimately, in over a period of 60 years, Dominion 60. Dominion has to return this to a greenfield site. So basically what that means is it needs to look like the farm fields that were here back in the 1960s prior to anybody getting an idea about putting a nuclear plant here. So that's the ultimate goal, but the company has 60 years to achieve that.
When would you envision the demolition of those buildings actually coming down? Would that be like 40 years from now, or is it hard to know?
I have a feeling I'll be long gone by then.
I'm sure I will.
Yeah, I mean, it's years and years and years down the road. What will also be happening is we do have the fuel in the spent fuel pool, and ultimately that will be moved out of the spent fuel pool and then to our dry storage pad, which we constructed back in 2009. The fuel that's coming out of the reactor right now is going to be too hot to move outside for a period of probably 10 years. So the spent fuel pool will remain operational for at least the next 10 years and perhaps beyond that in order to keep that fuel cool enough and to get it cooled down enough to be able to move it outside to our dry fuel storage area.
So can you describe that pool and how that operates and how this will be different as it's shut down?
All the fuel that has been used here at Kewaunee since 1974 is still here on site. A very small amount of that has been moved out of the spent fuel pool and out to our dry storage area. So the majority of the fuel that's been used here is still located in the spent fuel pool.
Why is that?
Well, the main reason that it's still here is because it belongs to the federal government. And they have not taken part in their responsibility of finding a suitable storage area for it. Of course, folks know that Yucca Mountain was the chosen method of geological disposal. Most recently, the Obama administration has stricken that from the budget and formed a Blue Ribbon Commission that looked at other options beyond Yucca Mountain and have not implemented any of those options to this point. So we're basically...
Needless to say, it's a very controversial... It worries some people.
it really slows down
the process, right?
To say the least. And you know, now it's become political. And so, you know, I don't anticipate any resolution in sight in the near future. So while the spent fuel remains here on site, we need to take care of it for the federal government until they decide... And the federal government, in this case being the Department of Energy, until they decide that they've got a suitable place to put it.
Mark Hans is a spokesman for Virginia-based Dominion Resources. He spoke with Susan Bentz in March about the process of shutting down the Kewaunee Nuclear Power Station. The plant stopped producing electricity yesterday after nearly 40 years of operation. We'll take a quick break now and then speak with someone who produced power in the water well past her 40th birthday. Five-time Olympic swimmer Dara Torres joins us in just a moment on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Those of us who have passed our 40th birthday pay close attention to athletes as they get older. While our real major league dreams may have long passed, there is comfort in seeing athletes your own age succeed against competitors far younger. Case in point, swimmer Dara Torres. Torres is the first American swimmer to compete in five Olympic Games. In fact, she was the oldest member of the U.S. Olympic swimming team in 2000 and went on to compete and win medals in both 2004 and 2008, for good measure. At age 45, Torres narrowly missed out on making the 2012 Olympic team, but she continues to serve as a role model for elite athletes and for the rest of us. Torres is in Wisconsin this week, having helped the Milwaukee-based Koss Corporation develop a line of fitness headphones, which is launching today. But first, she joined us in the studio. Welcome to Lake Effect. It is, in fact, an honor.
Thank you for having me.
You signed on at a really early age to the life of an elite athlete. At what point do you feel like you signed on to be a role model?
I don't think you ever think about being a role model when you sign on for a sport. I did a bunch of different sports when I was younger, and I just there was something about swimming, diving into the pool, being one with the water that I just really liked a lot. And then as I got a little bit older, I started to excel in the sport. And I guess I realized when I was probably a teenager, maybe my first Olympics when I was 17, that I started to be a role model for younger kids.
I mean, at some point, smaller kids must have been coming up to you and wanting to be you.
Yeah, but at that age, it's so surreal because you're 17. You're still in high school. And so it just seems like it just can't be happening that kids would come up and want your autograph and kind of want to be like you.
Well, and I wonder because, you know, there are all sorts of people who are coaching you how to, you know, how to improve your stroke, how to improve your breathing underwater, how to do everything in the water. Is there anybody that's teaching you to be a person as this is going on?
You know, I don't think there was anyone that would pull me aside and say, okay, this is how you have to be. But my parents were great role models. My coaches were great role models. I really was surrounded by just incredible people. So, you know, you learn by example, and that's kind of how I learned to be able to deal with everything that was being thrown at me.
Well, so after so many years of competing, you could easily be, you know, thinking about retirement gigs, but you're still on magazine covers, you're still in the press, you're still on TV. Why is it important for you to still be such a public figure?
It really isn't about being a public figure. I don't really care about that stuff. I just enjoy doing what I'm doing. I enjoy going out and giving motivational talks. I enjoy going on television and interviewing with people and interacting. It's just that's my personality. It's what I like to do. So I don't do it because I want to be seen. I do it because I really enjoy doing it.
We're having this conversation on Tuesday, shortly before you're scheduled to go talk with younger high school level swimmers. Mm-hmm. What do you say to kids? What is the message you bring as, and I hate to use this word, but an older athlete? Not an
older,
old athlete.
I think I'm older than their parents. So, you know, there's different messages that I like to you know, relay to the kids. And it could be anything from, you know, overcoming obstacles to using negativity to a positive aspect. It could be about what it's like to be at the high competition level that I was at with the Olympics. I mean, there's all sorts of different messages. I like to give a little bit of a talk, but when it comes to kids, I like them to ask questions too, because a lot of them always have lots of questions.
What are the kinds of questions that you get the most from them?
I had one little boy ask if I had a boyfriend. but no, I get asked a lot. It's amazing because at first they're all very quiet and, you know they want to ask, but they don't want to be the first one to ask. And then once someone does, it's like a domino effect. The questions start coming. And it could be everything to, you know, my favorite stroke, to what I think about before I swim. It just varies.
I don't know about you, but I did not think much about my 40s when I was 15 years old.
No, I didn't either. Let alone think about my 40s, but think I'd ever be swimming in my 40s. You know, when you're younger and your parents are in their 40s, you just think that's really, really old. And so when I decided to go about and make a comeback for the 08 Olympics, I was 39 years old and I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know how my body would react to it. I didn't know if I'd get injured easily. Like, I didn't know what to expect, but once something's in my head, I just do it. And so I was going to go for it.
You go to an event like you're doing today, or you go to a swim meet where there are, you know, 11, 12, 13-year-old swimmers that are out there. Is it difficult to watch them and not think about the stuff that you were dealing with and you were trying to do when you were their age?
You know, the hardest thing for me, I think, is not so much when I go to the meets, because, you know, you just kind of – you think about the time that you used to do that, and it's just all great memories for me. The hardest thing for me is going to my daughter's swim practices and trying not to say anything to the coaches if I see something maybe that's not right, and just sort of bite my lip and just stay in the background and let the coaches do their thing. So that, you know, sometimes you want to go up and give a little advice, but you don't want to step on anyone's toes. So I just kind of kick back. But the swim meets is fun because it just brings back memories.
What do you see? I mean, you say your daughter goes to swim practice. She is 7 years old. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the point at which your parents, you're a former Olympian, your daughter is swimming. How do you weigh the is she having fun versus is she doing her stroke the right way in the water?
I don't really worry about her stroke too much. You know, she is 7 years old. I don't think my stroke came about until I was a teenager. The coaches are doing a great job. They do lots of stroke work with her, you know, and dives and turns and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes when I do see her, I'm like, oh, I should take her back to the pool and you know, at our house and have her do this, this, and this. But, you know, she's doing just fine. I don't want to be one of those pushy parents. And she does have other activities that she's involved with. She does lacrosse and tennis and dance. And so she's pretty busy. And whatever she decides she wants to do down the road, you know, she can choose on her own. But I try to stay a little bit out of it.
Do you think the world comes at young athletes faster today than it did when you were one?
I think because of all the technology out there and social media that I think it does. I think you weren't as aware of things back when we were growing up because it just wasn't out there. I mean, you get a newspaper and you could read something about it the next day, but there weren't computers and Twitter and all that kind of stuff out there where everyone has an opinion and you can follow your favorite athlete and stuff. So I think it's much different now than it was back then.
High school football didn't used to be shown on national
right,
TV,
exactly.
For example. You know, you hear about some of the issues that young athletes deal with, anything from the concussion situation in contact sports. You hear about performance-enhancing drugs in younger and younger athletes as the stakes rise higher. Do you, as you see your daughter, slowly make her way up, do you think there are certain things she needs to keep her eyes on and you as a parent need to keep your eyes on as she gets older?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you don't want your child to get involved with stuff where there's going to be performance-enhancing drugs, obviously. And I'm lucky I have a daughter and not a son, so I don't have to worry so much about – I know she's not really into hockey, so anything with concussions and stuff like that. So I feel good about that. I think it would be different if I had a little boy. But, I being that I've been in this environment for so long, I know what to look for, and I'm very aware and will hopefully guide her in the right direction.
What would you go back and tell the teenage version of yourself?
love my teenage version. You know what? No matter what happened in my life when I was growing up, good or bad, I feel like it's molded me as to who I am today. So there's really nothing I would change back then. Probably if there was anything I would tell myself was maybe to have a little more patience. Not that it's any better now, but I look back and I mean, I really had just a wonderful life growing up and great teenage years, and there's really nothing I would change.
Beyond talking to young swimmers or young athletes, what do you think people in general ought to take from the life that you've lived and you're still living now? I mean, obviously, everyone's goal is not to make the Olympics in their 40s. You know, what should somebody who has more kind of modest goals in mind take from the kinds of stuff that you talk about?
Probably just to always keep those dreams coming and to set goals. I get asked a lot about, you know, how do you stay motivated? You've done it for so many years. And, you know, I'm just a goal setter. I mean, there are mornings where I get up and that alarm goes off and the last thing I want to do is go get in a cold pool. But I know I won't reach those goals if I don't do what I need to do. And so that's probably the biggest thing is to keep those dreams coming and set goals.
You're in Milwaukee at the moment. We mentioned that you're chatting with some young swimmers. Mm-hmm. You're also on board as an endorsed athlete by the COS Corporation. Mm-hmm. That you're working with them on a new line of headphones. And I'm curious, you know, how much input you as a person who has to stand up and talk about these kinds of things. What input do you have in the design, in, you know, this is something that really works for me as an athlete?
Well, my first swim meet, really big swim meet, was nationals. I was 13 years old, and I'd never been in such a heavy elite surrounding with all these athletes. I remember walking into the locker room and women were shaving their legs and their arms, like, what are they doing? And, you know, I was so nervous. I didn't know how I was going to get ready for this race. And I'll never forget just grabbing my Walkman. You remember Walkmans?
Oh, yeah.
And a pair of headphones and just listening to music before I swam. And then I realized I was kind of the staple of how I would get ready before my races. And so music has been a huge, huge part of my life, not only for getting ready for my races. And you see a lot of athletes, see Michael Phelps with headphones on. Everyone likes to listen to music. But now that I'm even done swimming, I work out a lot and I like music. And so for me, it was very hard to find a headphone that, you know, would fit well in the ear, that was comfortable, wouldn't fall out when you're working out, because a lot of them, you know, they don't feel like they're small enough to fit in the ear. And so the great thing about this new line of earbuds and fit clips that I've been working on with COS is that they were designed by women and made for women. So that's really important, you know. And, you know, I helped with the design some and chose the colors and just really was a part of it. So it's fun to be able to get out there and start talking to people about this wonderful headphone. And I work out with them, and I mean, I run and I jump and I do everything, and these things just stay in the ear and they're great.
I imagine you cannot swim with them, though.
No, you can't swim with them, but I don't even swim now anymore. After I went to Olympic trials in July and I missed making the team by 9/100ths of a second, I kind of hung my suits up to dry and just am really enjoying doing dry land training and cross training, and it's just a lot of fun to be able to do that.
You know, you mentioned the whole idea of putting the headphones on. We see Michael Phelps put the headphones mm-hmm. on before a meet, and we see lots of athletes in lots of different sports do that. You know, it's sort of one thing when your average radio producer goes to the gym and puts the headphones on and uses it maybe as a motivator or a beat setter or whatever. What is the need that an athlete has to I mean, I guess talk about the idea of tuning everything out with something like music?
Well, everyone has their own ways of getting ready before they compete. And for me personally, I'm not a visualizing type person. Like, I feel like if I did all the work in the pool and the gym and everything I was supposed to do, that by the time I get ready for my meet, I should be ready to go. I shouldn't have to visualize my races. So I like music that is upbeat, that gets me going, but that also keeps my mind off of the task at hand, because all I want to do is get that music going, be pumped up, stand on the blocks and swim my race and have fun. I don't like to think about what I'm doing. And so I think for every athlete, it's different about how they get ready. But for me, it was about sort of tuning out and listening to these great tunes and being psyched about my race.
Is it too much to say? Is it a Zen thing? Is it staying in the moment?
No, it's not a Zen thing for me. It's just about, you know, you put all this work into this. You probably didn't sleep well the night before, so you're kind of tired, and so you want something to kind of pump you up. And music was always my go-to. I mean, like I said, ever since my first really big meet when I was 13 years old, and I'd been doing that up until, you know, Olympic trials. This past my sixth Olympic trials in July, last July, that's how I got ready for my race, was listening to music.
I don't want to assume anything, but you said you've hung up the swimsuit, so I imagine the 2016 Olympics are not in your plans.
No, the 2016 Olympics, unless I go watch, they're definitely not in my plans.
Well, so what are the challenges that you set out for yourself today?
I always have stuff going on. I love giving motivational talks. I love being there for my daughter more so. I mean, it was tough with my training, and, you know, now I can go to more of her school activities and her after school activities. And, you know, I love giving swim clinics. I mean, I definitely keep busy and try to be able to give back in my community and with my swimming and my career and stuff. So I keep busy, and it's just all been fun. It's been, you know, I think people think, oh my gosh, retirement, especially after all the years I've been doing it, but it's been a nice change of pace.
Do you see the idea of being a role model for your daughter as any different than being a role model for the public at large? Obviously, you're not telling the world to do their homework.
No, no. And my daughter and I have a really, really good rapport and great relationship. And, you know, sometimes it gets to the point where I act so immature with her that all we do is laugh and giggle and have fun. But I like to be a role model for her. And I don't think she really sees that yet because I'm just mom. I think hopefully when she gets older, she'll see that. She didn't even really know what the Olympics were. I mean, she kind of knows but doesn't know. And I remember one day she came home and she's like, Mom, you know, it's really cool that you were an Olympic swimmer. I'm like, all right, what parent told their kid that told you? You know what I mean? Like, it was just – but it was funny because she had never said that before. And she knew all about the Olympics, but she didn't really, I think, get the concept of it.
Has she watched your races?
She came to Olympic trials. She's been to other races, but I don't think she remembers them. But the Olympic trials, she does remember, and she was really, really bummed that I didn't make it. And I don't think it was so much because she wanted to see me compete. I think it was more so, well, then she didn't get to see Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte, you know. So, yeah, but I ended up taking her anyway, and we had a really good time. But, yeah, all she understands is win-lose. She doesn't understand that, like, second place is okay or, you know. So she's like, Mom, you lost, you know. And I'm like, she made me feel so bad. But I don't think she really got it.
Well, and what about, you know, you must have videotapes of your previous Olympic.
Yeah, but I don't. And unless she gets to an age where she wants to, you know, see that stuff, I'm not one. Like, my medals have been in a safe for a long time. And I don't, unless someone asks me about swimming, I don't really talk about swimming. That's just not my nature to do that. So if she gets to the point where she wants to see stuff, I have boxes of tapes and DVDs that she can look at.
As such a lifelong competitor, is it hard for you at this stage of your life to watch others and know that you aren't going to be able to compete for the Olympics again?
You know, I'm actually okay with it. When I got out of my race and I placed fourth and then just missed the team in July, I think my mom was crying and more upset than I was. I feel like I gave it everything I had, and there's nothing else I can give. You know, I don't think what people realize is that at these Olympic trials, my time here was faster than I swam in the 84, 88, and 92, and 2000 Olympics. The only time I ever went faster was in 08. So it's just the girls got faster. I mean, there's only so much my body could do at my age. So I was okay with it. Like, I know that chapter is closed, and I'm okay with it.
How would you assess the health of USA Swimming at this stage?
I think USA Swimming is doing wonderfully, and I think different swimmers have put swimming on the map, like the Michael Phelps and the Ryan Lochtes and the Missy Franklins. It seems like every time there's Olympic Games, going into USA Swimming and signing up for it has increased more and more over the years because of the notoriety that swimming's getting, and I think that's been awesome for the sport.
Do you think – is there ever a point at which swimmers just will not be able to get any faster?
I don't know. It seems like everyone's getting faster over the years, so we'll see. Hopefully it's not because of technology. That's more just because, you know, the body's changing and swimmers is getting faster.
Well, Dara Torres, thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Dara Torres competed in 5 Olympic Games and won 12 medals in swimming. She's also author of 2 books, Age is Just a Number and Gold Medal Fitness. Torres, who lives in Massachusetts, is in Milwaukee this week. She met with members of the Waukesha Express swim team yesterday, and today will help Milwaukee-based Koss Corporation launch a line of fitness headphones at an event in Mequon. There's a link to more information from WUWM.com/lakeeffect. Another break, and when we return, Wisconsin foodie Kyle Cherik on a surprising boom in restaurants in Milwaukee. That's when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Considering the challenging economy of the past few years, Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik might have some surprising news. Milwaukee's new local restaurant scene is booming. Cherik is host and producer of Wisconsin Foodie on PBS and a writer and blogger on the local food movement. He explains to Lake Effect's Bonnie North why he believes Milwaukee is bucking a national trend.
My original contribution for this month was going to be about the spring menus and the amazing bounty of Wisconsin, you know, stuff that's coming out of the ground. And the menu flips, essentially. And I thought, you know, that's a little bit like describing trombones at a parade. We know. And really, the impetus for this was a acquaintance reaching out on Facebook and saying, I need a new place to eat. And then she ticked off 14 amazing restaurants, the majority of which had just, I realized, opened in the last year or two. So I tersely but politely wrote her back and said, are you crazy? You should probably go back to these places. But, you know, we're missing the forest for the trees. So, yeah, since 2008, it's almost not fair. So that the crash hit in October. So let's go 2009, 2010. Now, this is anecdotal. This is not scientific. This is anecdotal. But the research that I did calling restaurant associations around the Midwest, basically calling B-tier cities around the country, anybody that I can think of. As far as I can tell, we have opened the most restaurants in the last 3 years of any city, exempting San Francisco, New York, L.A., and like a Phoenix, Scottsdale. And that's, you know, their numbers are very generalized. So if it's a Ted's Taco Hut, they're including that in. For me, I mean, I want the high caliber or the greatly accessible or the inventive or at least the interesting. Doesn't have to be expensive kind of places. And the edge of the Third Ward in Walker's Point has become this incredible culinary hub. I mean, I've lived in Walker's Point for now 17 years. And when I moved in, I was just happy to get a gas station. Now you can essentially get some of the best food in the entire city in Bayview, the Odd Duck, going through Walker's Point and then to the southern edge of the Third Ward, which is not to say there aren't great other restaurants elsewhere. But right now, on fear of penalty of friendship and death, I know of three restaurants that we can't talk about that will be opening in that Walker's Point near Third Ward area within the next 6-7 months that haven't even been announced.
So what do you think is the reason that all of these restaurants, A, are opening here? Why are we such a restaurant town? And then B, why are they so successful in the teeth of a recession?
Sure. Well, as far as the neighborhoods, the near Third Ward, the southern Third Ward in Walker's Point, every chef that I know has told me the same thing. It's where they could afford to get space. It's just that simple. The rest of Third Ward's too expensive. Wauwatosa, you don't have the density. The east side, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But that's where they can afford to do what they want to do. And if you're a chef and you've been moving through all the rungs of evolution, you know, it's like anybody. Eventually you want to own your own place and hang your own shingle and cook the food that you want to cook and place it against the public's imagination and see if it works. And it's not a happy day when it fails, if it does, but then you know and you can move on. I mean, you know, we have Circa 1880. We've got Kasana down in the Third Ward. Odd Duck, I mentioned before. Braise, 812 opened up in out in Brookfield. Umami Moto just went through a remodel. Rumpus Room, Joey Girard's two locations in the last year and a half, 2 years. Cafe Paloma, the Noble, has got their own Kickstarter thing to keep that restaurant going, but that's a young, little, great place. And I'm missing a ton of people. I mean, this is unscientific again. There's some favorites out there. But just in the next couple of months, we've got Blue Jacket opening up around basically right behind La Miranda and Walker's Point. We've got Barvette, which is Karen Bell's place, which is going to be this great charcuterie kind of thing. We've got Gouda, which is going to be another charcuterie with a speakeasy in the back, opening up on Water Street in the Third. Here's the reasons why that I can tell. We have a dynamic culinary school here in Milwaukee. It's accredited and one of only eight in the country that's accredited at that level. Then we've got a statewide culinary program that's incredible. Then we've got this great training ground within the Bartolotta Group and the Surge Group and the Marcus Group and other, where chefs, if they're graduating, or I was talking to Dan Van Wright from Hinterland the other day. He said, I have more really qualified people that are talented and don't have experience but that are good coming to me than I can hire. So when you have that kind of bubbling up, you know, these little places are going to soak up that talent and they're going to cultivate them. And then we're going to have all these great little, as we do, restaurants.
But then on the other side, you still have to have people come. And it's still a business and they still have to be supported by the public.
Right.
And so that's the piece that I find so fascinating is that we somehow, in the face of a recession, we
right.
have enough people out there who are willing to spend their hard-earned money to go to all these different restaurants and make them successful.
Bonnie, it does not make sense. It's like Milwaukee with so many other things. We shouldn't have all the universities we have. We shouldn't have the sports teams. We shouldn't have et cetera. We shouldn't have the county stuffs, the zoos, the blah, blah, blah. We should not have this many restaurants based on per capita and population. And, you know, I was just talking to a friend of mine who grew up in Europe and Spain, and he was talking about the food culture there, and everybody lives in the moment and enjoys life. And I thought, we're at the Bar of Lake Park Bistro. This place is packed. And I know right now there are hundreds of thousands of Milwaukeeans that are out enjoying the food scene. Maybe we don't do it with as much aplomb as the Spanish, and maybe not as late. But we're a food town. It's just undeniable. You can't have this many restaurants, either from big enterprises like Bartolotta or small little husband and wife groups or single chefs opening up within basically what has been the single worst recession we've had since the big one that everybody reads about in the history books.
And that's what fascinates me is that somehow all of this is happening. And I, you know, I know personally of people who are opening restaurants mm-hmm. as well. And it seems that, well, we love to eat, of course, but there's something else going on. There's some sort of alchemical thing
seems
to be happening.
Yeah,
here.
There's a vibrancy, and we've talked about this before in my segments. The chefs are really talking to each other and working together. I was at this gorgeous, great pop-up dinner not too while ago, the Food for Thought. There were six restaurants, everything from a small little cafe, the National with Nell, to Justin Aprahamian, who's nominated for the third time for a James Beard, all doing courses and moving from restaurant to restaurant for each event. This one was in the Odd Duck. I mean, it's they all feed. It's a little Silicon Valley, and I just loathe that title, but it's true. Everybody's feeding off of each other for the most part in a really convivial way, and I have yet to hear someone say, oh, I hope they don't rock it because it'll affect my business. I have never heard that.
But talking about that in terms of business, do you think that we'll get to the point where we're saturated and there just can't be another restaurant that could be successful?
No, not for food, because it's becoming one of the reasons why people want to live here and or move here. It won't be – well, maybe for some people it'll be the main reason because the food seems so dynamic. When Visit Milwaukee hired me a little while ago for one of their tours to show meeting planners, they found that the two things that people want to do when they're not at a convention is shop and eat. I said, well, you know, I can't help you on the shopping side, but this is grounds. I mean, it's so amazing. So it will be a reason why people stay and why more people will come, and that will just self-perpetuate itself basically until we run out of space.
So you don't see this slowing down?
No. The argument that you're going to slice the pie up so many times, that just doesn't prove true for restaurant scenes. It never has. I mean, people love to eat. They love to be together. This is how we started telling stories around a fire while we realized that boar tastes better when it was slightly crisp and not dripping with blood. I mean, this is one of the single most fundamental things about being a human being, and you can extrapolate that through history. So no, it will help attract the best and the brightest and the most interesting and some of the most enthusiastic eaters, but we'll never run out of. And our ingredients source, I mean, we're number one in the country on proteins. We're number one on produce. We're number one on grain, or maybe you could argue two or barely three. You know, we have a soft spot as far as seafood. That's fair. But otherwise, the ingredients that these chefs can access, that's exciting. You know, you're a Formula One mechanic. You want to work on a Formula One team and you want to have the best tool and die shop right there next to you. It's the same story. You're a chef. You want great ingredients.
And we obviously have the patrons who want to come and try all of this out. And that's the other part of this equation that I find fascinating, that there are people who are so interested. I mean, you talk about New York and L.A. and San Francisco. Everybody on the coasts gets the credit for having the adventurous palate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. That's just phoning it in. That doesn't really count. I mean, how many people, millions, shuffle through all of those cities every day? And either with an expense account or what? I mean, that's the great thing about Milwaukee is we're doing it for ourselves, by ourselves, which we always have, which is why I'm here, which is what's so inspiring about this city. But the culinary scene here is playing that out. When you have a chef like Thomas from 1880 who traveled France basically illegally after his green card expired so that he could cook with great chefs and then come back to Milwaukee to want to do that, that says something more profound than anything I could ever put on the radio, write in an article, or do on TV, you know. And he got an SBA loan, and boom, it's terrific.
So more to eat.
Yes.
Yum.
Yeah.
Yum.
And the season is coming in. But I would urge everybody, I mean, go to the places and get something that isn't typical for you. Anybody can do a steak. Anybody can do a, you know, I don't know, pasta bolognese. Anybody can, not anybody, but it's, those are the easy things. If we've got chefs that are stretching for you, reach out and grab it back. It's only fair.
And it would be delicious.
And it most likely.
Well, Kyle, as always, yum, yum, yum. Now I'm hungry. We always do this around lunch. How do we always do this around lunch?
I know. We got to change.
We got to change the time.
Yeah,
so anyway, as always, such a pleasure. And we will talk to you next month.
Thanks for having me.
Kyle Cherik is host and producer of the public television show Wisconsin Foodie and writes a regular column for Milwaukee Magazine's website. He's also our regular local food trends contributor, and he spoke with Bonnie North. One last break, and when we return, another Wisconsin business that is taking off, but with a product that goes on your mouth, not in it. We will learn more when Lake Effect continues on WUWN. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Not so long ago, the mega sports network ESPN hosted its Wisconsin Sports Awards. And with that announcement came the news that one of the firms trying to make a splash with the athletes at the awards was a homegrown lip balm company. You might not think lip balm would be an especially easy field to break into. Yet Sheboygan's Caitlin Brotz is carving a niche for her company called Oliveview 426, in which lip balm meets the DIY movement. Brotz is with us in the Lake Effect studio to explain. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mitch. It's great to be here.
I was hoping you could start by sharing the story of Oliveview 426. I gather you never set out to be a lip balm expert.
That certainly wasn't my intentions. As I started into college, I didn't really know what I wanted to be. A recent graduate at the time of Lakeland College up in Sheboygan County, I was studying business at the time when a gentleman that I was dating, Adam, at the time, he was building a snowmobile track to practice racing on and was using some gasoline to burn some brush away when, unfortunately, turn of events, the wind blew over and he was burned pretty substantially. Flight for life down to Milwaukee here at St. Mary's Burn Unit, where his therapist, Eileen, didn't want him using store-bought lip balm. She felt it was sort of a gimmick. She wanted something that was going to help heal. So she gave me a recipe and I went home eagerly to make it for him and followed the recipe to a T. And lo and behold, I was left with about 500 lifetime supplies of lip balm and thinking to myself, what on earth am I going to do with this all? That's really where my story starts.
Well, and so talk about that first batch that you made and obviously made more of it than you realized was going to come out of it. How did it work?
It worked really, really great. Adam really liked it. It was really soothing on his lips, of course. And so when I had so much of the lip balm, I thought, what am I going to do? I said, well, maybe I don't want to waste it. I'll give it out to my friends. So that's what I did. I gave it out to my friends. And pretty soon I couldn't go anywhere because people were saying, hey, do you have any wore that lip balm. It was really great. So, yeah, I was known as the lip balm girl. I carried it with me everywhere.
What was in that recipe, if you don't mind sharing?
Sure. You know, it's nothing that you can't find on our website. Olive oil and beeswax. We keep it very simple, very basic. We don't like to jumble it up with confusion. Sometimes less is more. And in our case, a basic recipe works really, really well for everyone.
I mean, what's interesting about it is what you were saying is this idea of using it to heal, whereas I think a lot of people think of lip balm as just something that they throw on the lips and it's going to protect them from the wind or the sun or whatever. But this I mean, the whole idea of this was in a therapeutic way.
Yeah. You know, I think that brings us to commercial products and, you know, what people are using them for. A lot of times you'll find petroleum in your lip balms, which is a lubricant, true, but it doesn't have the healing properties. In fact, it's an anti-humectant. It wicks moisture away from the skin. So when you switch it up a little bit and give your skin something that it can use to self-heal, you'll find it's a lot more effective. Also, from a medical standpoint, if you're in a hospital where you're often dry, you can't use petroleum-based products when you're on oxygen.
Well, and so where did it go from there? How did you go from making this one large batch and always carrying some around with you to making it what you do for a living?
I started researching different oils that would help Adam heal with minimal scarring, and that led us to the emu oil, which is therapeutically one of the best oils on the market. So I started dabbling in making lotions, and as I started exploring my homemade options, started dabbling in other things, soaps and sugar scrubs, and making them for the people who were asking for them. And then they started asking me, could you put this fragrance in and that color in and this herb in? And before you knew it, my kitchen turned into a giant lab, and I thought to myself it would be nice if they could make it themselves and customize it themselves. That way it's exactly how they want it. That was my light bulb moment, and that's when I decided that maybe I would want to make a career out of this.
Well, and presumably your goal was not to continue making it in your kitchen.
Yes, for the sake of my sanity, I knew I couldn't make it in my kitchen anymore, so I decided instead of making it in my kitchen, I'd make it in your kitchen. So I started off with the home parties, bringing it into people's homes, letting them make it in their kitchen with the party, with their friends around them, and filling their kitchens up with the wonderful aromas and fragrances that go into the product.
Well, and so you said this is a light bulb moment for you. This must be a light bulb moment for a lot of people, because I don't know that a lot of people have considered the idea that they could make this stuff at home. I mean, you see it on the shelf at stores, and it does not seem like it would be easy to make.
It isn't necessarily easy to make without a lot of guidance, minimal guidance, really, I should say. What we do is we kind of take the guesswork out of it for you. We have it set up in more of a very elementary way that makes it rather difficult for you to mess it up. So we really enjoy bringing you in and educating you on what the different ingredients will do for your skin, and helping you as a consumer make the decision on what you want to put on your skin. You know yourself better than anybody else does, and it's remarkably fun.
Well, and so talk about who you turn to learn about this, because, you know, you obviously got that recipe at the start from this therapist, but all of the other kinds of things that you make and you help other people make, how did you learn about it, and how did you learn how to scale it up?
You know, it was definitely a new arena. This was before the time of Facebook, before the time of Pinterest, before the time of a lot of things. And so really, I had to be self-taught. When I talked to a local chef about bringing people in and how do you train people to be able to do what you're doing, because essentially we're cooking for our skin. And he says, Kate, the difference is that when I bring in a cook, they already know how to cook. You know, when you bring on somebody, they don't know how to make cosmetics. So, like I said, one foot in front of the other, reading, research, trial and error, a lot of trial and error, getting the recipes to where I liked them.
How do you think this business fits in with who you are and what's important to you?
You know, I think it so much rings with who I am that it's something that I can put in many, many, many hours a day and not get sick of it one bit. It's a passion, and I encourage anybody who has a passion, you know, try to think, how might I develop that into a business? Because when you have the passion, it's just it makes it so enjoyable. You don't really even think about what you're doing. And the next thing you know, you're making a living at it. I've always been a hands-on person. I've always been a crafty person. And I've always liked being able to make things for myself besides cosmetics. I enjoy dabbling in beer making and wine making. I have bees. I have a garden. You know, I think true to how so many people as of more recently know that they want to take things into their own hand, whether it be their health, whether it be their food choices, whether it be what they put on their skin, that I think we're a lot more involved with the products that we handle and use every day. And that's really all I'm doing.
It started with the lip balm, obviously. Had you given much thought to lip balm before it became what you do?
Only the fact that, like so many women out there, I like lip balm, I like perfume, I like shower gel, I liked everything. You know, oftentimes on top of my desk was about 50,000 different fragrances because my life just wouldn't be the same without all of them. So I'm just like every other woman with a passion for beauty and cosmetics, as it's always been and always will be.
Can you talk about what your business, what Olivu consists of today? I mean, you go to your website and there is quite the menu of things that you do and make. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Where we started off with about 5 products when we opened our doors back in 2006, we're now up to over 100 products. You name it, we have it. If we don't, we'll make it, right? So besides doing the in-shop, we also are online. You can customize everything online and we'll ship it to you. We certainly have a number of clients in the Milwaukee area, all the way up to the Appleton area, and as far as Hong Kong, Canada, Puerto Rico, worldwide, right? And so besides shipping all over the world, we're in numerous hospitals. So we're in the hospitals up in the Sheboygan area and some hospice programs. We do some spa retail, and we are trying to branch into the wholesale. However, if you go on our website, you see how affordable our products are already, each one individually poured, and they're so fresh, it's hard to kind of send them out to where they may sit on shelves.
Well, and so as you're making things to order, you know, the part of your business that isn't going into other people's kitchens, do you have an industrial kitchen that you're cooking this up in, or is it back in your own kitchen?
Heavens, thankfully, I've been able to move out of my own kitchen and I can cook food in there again. We're now into more of the industrial kitchen. If you come up to our shop, you're free to come in and watch us make the products fresh and even give your input as to what you would like in your finished product.
So you do have a more traditional storefront where people can come in and have it made to order while they're standing there.
Yep. Otherwise, the catch is they actually can make it. It's totally up to the consumer. We make it, they make it, whatever they'd prefer. If they are more of a hands-on type of a person, they're more than welcome to come in and do it themselves. If they're more of a person who wants us to do it for them, we're happy to help them.
What's been the bigger challenge for you? Has it been the actual making and marketing of the stuff or the business part of the equation?
Well, definitely the business part of it. For anybody who wants to be an entrepreneur, I believe that it's one thing to have a passion for your trade. It's another to have a passion for business. I definitely have a passion for business. I love it, and I'm eager to learn more about it. I'm eager to network out with other people. I'm definitely a people person. And so I have no problem reaching out and trying to express what it is that we do as a company. We love people. We love helping people. And so business is such an interesting field.
What about the networking element to this? I mean, I imagine as somebody who makes and markets this kind of stuff, it would be great to have it in the hands of some high-profile people. Has that been part of your business model?
Yeah, absolutely. High profile is awesome. We cater from just your regular Joe all the way up to your high profile. We recently, as you know, had the opportunity to have our products featured in the ESPN Wisconsin Sports Award bags, which was a huge deal for us to be able to get it in the hands of Aaron Rodgers, Ryan Braun. We were also invited to attend the show, so I got to talk to Amon Green a little bit about it, an experience that I don't think that would have been possible in my lifetime had it not been from the aspect of the business. So to be able to get the word out there and to be able to continue to spread the word is what makes it such an exciting field to be in.
Did you make a special recipe for the athletes who were going to get these?
Nope. We used our starter package, which is available online, the Olive Oof starter package, for $22 they each got. So they got a sugar scrub, a lotion, a soap, a lip balm, and a hydrating face mist. However, we are looking forward to possibly having some of them down to customize some products. From what I've been told from an agent, they too like to use natural products. You don't really think about that too often, but if a athlete is going to be in his top performing conditioner or her top performing condition, what they eat as well as what they put on their bodies is very important to the best health that they can be in.
How long does it take for you to go from an idea for a product to the point where you're ready to let people order it and make it?
Well, I like to move at the speed of fast. And so, you know, I, being a woman, have been with cosmetics so long, and now kind of being able to understand ingredients and what their purpose is in a formulation can generally take a formulation from start to finish pretty quickly. Don't think, though, that there haven't been formulations we've tried that we've had to kick out, kick to the curb. You know, we definitely rely on customer feedback. That's why our customers are so great. They oftentimes will come to me with an idea, and I'll say, "Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll help do this, but you have to be my guinea pig, and you have to give me the feedback." And you know, then we go from there.
I was going to ask whether you are your own guinea pig.
Oftentimes in this field, people will be concerned. They'll come in and they'll want to make sure that they aren't buying a product that's been tested on animals, rightfully so. I sometimes giggle and I say our products are not tested on animals, only on boyfriends.
So, yeah, I can't even.
I always, the guys always blush on that one. If you guys could see him, he's blushing behind the mic.
I am. Well, Caitlin Brotz, thank you so much, and best of luck.
Thank you so much again for having me on the show. It's really great to be a part of it.
Caitlin Brotz is the founder of Olive You 426, a lip balm and beauty products company based in Sheboygan. There's a link to information about the DIY store and more about the company from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's all for the Wednesday edition of the program. Tomorrow, an update on the war against the emerald ash borer in Wisconsin, plus much more. I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.